welcome to the JMSC News. Covering the International Media Conference here at Hong Kong U. JMSC students spent their afternoon at the Graduate House here in Hong Kong U. They attended workshops and interviewed participants on the second day at the International Media Conference. What follows is a selection of comments from visiting journalists and academics. Our top audio team is Oscar Lin, Richard McCauley, Joy Zhou, and Curtin Andwani. I'm Rebecca Valli. Stay tuned. Let's begin with master student Richard McCauley. He attended the discussion session on reporting conflicts and spoke with Shyam Sikwani, who led the workshop. First, he asked about reporters covering insurgencies and how the media can inform the public without giving publicity to terrorist groups.
I think it's important to present alternate points of view. And traditionally, it's been seen as the moment you publish the enemy in quotation marks, point of view, you're doing the country a disservice, which I think is essentially wrong. Because you have a group of people with grievances, and unless they get their point of view out, it's going to be hard to work at a dialogue in trying to resolve the conflict. That's one. Number two, the media, of course, also has to be aware that it shouldn't use those occasions to sensationalize the information they receive. They've got to ensure fair play and, more important, responsibility in contextualizing every act of violence, every statement of violence, and if it's of, it's only if it's of news value. If it isn't, if it's going to be there just for the sake of being there or some other dubious reason, then they are being very irresponsible.
Mr. Thekwani also spoke about the issues for freelance journalists reporting conflicts.
Well, yeah, I touched on that briefly, freelancers and stringers. Now, if they are trained, if a stringer is trained, great. But most publications tend to look for cutting costs, so they try and get somebody cheap. And obviously, if you're a highly qualified and trained reporter, you're not going to go cheap. So the quality of reporting becomes suspect, most often, not all the time. And freelancers, the only advice I'll have for them is if you're covering a conflict, you probably want to be in areas which are not being crowded by the mainstream media, because everybody's preoccupied with a particular event or a situation or a person. But if you've stepped back and, you know, looked around, and if you know your stuff, if you really research the topic well, you're going to start finding facts which are more relevant and important to the story than what everybody's rushing for.
When asked about common flaws the mainstream media makes when reporting conflicts, Mr. Thekwani suggested context is the main issue.
But some of them tend to take it to an extreme, and they think by just blanketing news, blacking out news, they're doing the readers and the country a service, which I think is wrong. It's important to contextualize. Whatever is of news value has to be contextualized.
Things may be changing, however, and it's down to citizen journalism, he said, for the following two reasons.
Well, I think the backlash is going to come, if it comes, and that is because of citizen journalism. The media is going to be, it has to be on its toes, because you have so many people out there with the video cameras and mobile cameras, mobile phones with cameras, who are putting in stories. And some of the mainstream media has recognized the value of having citizens report for them. New York Times, BBC, they tend to do that. It's done two things. One is it's put them on the toes to be more alert to issues which they traditionally have not bothered about because they didn't think it merited space. And now they're looking at issues which didn't matter to them before. And number two is they're improving their methods of authentication and verifying information that they get. So I think it's for the good.
That was Shyam Sikwani, Professor of Media and Conflict at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu. He was interviewed by Richard McCauley. Richard will feature again with more interviews later. Coming up next is Kirti Nandwani. She reports on how the media should cover documentary films in Hong Kong, but also elsewhere.
Short films and documentaries tell a very special story in comparison to mainstream cinema. Documentaries have a voice It gives the world a full insight into certain issues of a country. I spoke to the president of AsiaPacificFilms.com, Mrs. Janet Paulson, and asked her a question. What can journalists do to promote these documentaries?
For the documentary, I think they can find out how it was made and tell that story as well as what's in it. But I think the documentary maker has a point of view, and it's really important to find out what that point of view is and how that was made as an important story.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I give an example of my own film, The Land Has Eyes. It's not really, it's a docudrama, but it's more of a feature narrative. But, you know, the writer director's from a small little island, and he went around to villages and interviewed the people who the story was about, wanted to show his people the film first, and got consensus to make that film. That's important when you write about it.
Next, I spoke to Ms. Teresa Kwong of NetPAC and promoter of Hong Kong Independent Short Films and Video Awards. She tells us about it. What is IFVA?
So IFVA is called Hong Kong Independent Short Film and Video Awards. So we launched in 1995, so now we're celebrating the 60th edition. So what we're doing is we serve like a platform for nurturing and promoting Hong Kong and Asian creative talent in moving images.
What are the certain things you've been doing with the community?
Oh, we have an annual competition that is open for all Asian people. At the same time, we will have a series of outreach projects with the community. For example, this year we have a project with the local South Asian teenagers. We have workshop with them, so just to empower them using video to express themselves.
How are you distributing some of the videos, short films?
Okay, we do it in a number of ways. First of all, we quite rely on the festival distribution. Every year we will have the award work, so we will promote proactively send it to overseas festival. So just in a way, just to increase the exposure of these works in the region. And all in all, we also we have DVD. We will include all our award title and then publish in a DVD, and it's available where people could buy it and get a copy of it. And then last of all, we also try to develop more opportunity for this award title. Like we will have some collaboration with some online partner, and also we are thinking of, we would like to have more program showing these award work in the public area.
You just listened to Curtin and Duane's interview with participants of the talk Critics and Creativity, Emerging Voices in the Asia-Pacific Cinema. Kirti is a BJ here at the JMSC and a documentary filmmaker herself. She recently produced a short film on gender stereotyping in Asia. Next, MJ student Joy Zhou went to a session called The Future of Hong Kong. Here's her report.
Hong Kong enjoys a unique position as the most politically liberal city in China. Its people here are very concerned about the issue of democracy. Mr. Mark Sheldon, the honorary lecturer for International Asian Studies program from the Chinese University of Hong Kong, talks about the prospects for democracy in Hong Kong.
We're in a situation where basically all the polling data shows that 60 to 70% of the Hong Kong people actually do want democratization to occur sooner rather than later. And the general feeling of the community has been that the steps taken by the Hong Kong government have been timid at best, wholly inadequate on occasion. There's some new forces out there that are making the situation more eclectic, more interesting, more unpredictable. They have a lot to do with the post-80s group, the student group. I'm teaching at Chinese U, so I have a lot of contact with this group and sort of know them well and know what they're thinking and how this is, in a sense, changing some of the equation about the political landscape of Hong Kong. We can be members of political parties, so we can be very active. So it's a very open situation for foreigners like myself who are actually members of the Hong Kong community for many, many, many decades. We have the League for Social Democrats and the Civic Party trying to bring some new pressures to bear on this whole question of the pace of democratization by having some of their LegCo members resign to create a by-election, a sort of de facto referendum. I personally was not in favor of this initially, but I can quite understand that this is one method whereby some of the community's frustration about the pace of democratization can be expressed, where there can be additional civic education and debate and dialogue. So we will have in mid-May an election where in each of the five geographical areas of Hong Kong, there will be an election where these resigned LegCo members, several from the League for Social Democrats and several from the Civic Party, will then run for their seats again, in a sense, try to create this as a referendum for universal suffrage at a faster pace. Quite frankly, it's not going to work. All of the, in the local press, some of you who are here locally, some of you internationally might have seen that there's been a lot of new issues raised about conservation, about historic issues, about the high-speed railway. And basically, this is new people who are coming in to raise issues about what they see as the collusion between the Hong Kong government and big business. What they see is Hong Kong government not being responsive to the clearly stated democratic expressions of the community over many decades. And these new students, primarily, and young people, organize themselves in new ways through social networks. They like street demonstrations and guerrilla theater. They're wholly convinced that the Hong Kong government cannot adequately address the social and political reform needs of the community. So this is a new group of people that are not as moderate and reasonable as ANA. They're not as moderate and reasonable as the Pan Democrats. They're certainly not as modest and reasonable as Civic Exchange and all these traditional pan-democratic groups. There are people who have a great deal of frustration and concern and anxiety about their futures. They don't think they can find a house to buy or a job to have, and their degree of frustration and their degree of risk in their political activity is much, much lower than most normal people. Just to conclude, it's so clear that the frustration is building and that the tone in the pan-democratic camp, particularly amongst these new elements of civil society who are opposing the government's delay, the government's resistance on these changes, that tone has changed to a much more surly tone. You can feel the change now. So just to alert you that this can't go on too much longer without some kind of unfortunate ending.
Mr. Chris Young, the chairman of Hong Kong News Executive Association and the news director of Hong Kong Economic, shares his opinion about the development of Hong Kong media.
Like media in many places, the media in Hong Kong is facing a set of challenges. Last year, most newspapers faced very difficult times. The profit margin was pretty thin. I think they have not yet returned to the significantly. On the financial side, I think the situation has only began to improve in the second half when the overall economy recovers. And then the online news has not yet provided a steady source of revenue, even though most media, printed and electronic media, have tried to explore extra sources of revenue from online services, newspapers, and actually also electronic media. But they have managed to survive and grabbed actually advertising dollars from the paid newspapers. No major newspapers have closed down in the last 10 years or so. Major newspapers or second or third tier newspapers have managed to survive. Hu Shuli said this morning that traditional media in China is rising. In Hong Kong, I would say that the situation is a bit flat. Traditional media trying to diversify their business and on the other hand, also keep a pretty tight control about expenditures. Now most media have been more vigilant to this kind of a cost control, and on the other hand, to find additional room for growth. Media in Hong Kong, although it's no longer a very high profit margin, but still very strong incentive for existing players and potential investors to come into the business.
You just listened to Joy Jo reporting on the future of Hong Kong. And now, Oscar Lin, a Bachelor of Journalism student. He has a report on a session called Regional Architecture. Asia-Pacific countries are playing an increasingly important role in global affairs. This afternoon, four veteran reporters from Australia, Japan, South Korea, and Thailand share their opinions about regional politics and economics.
Regional architecture is not actually about building a landscape. It's about the building of regional community, such as the long-standing well-known Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. As a senior reporter from Australia, one of the member countries of APEC, Ms. Philippa McDonald first introduced Australia's role in the Asia-Pacific region.
Australia is in the Asia-Pacific and very much a participant in what has been called the Asia-Pacific century. Australia is deeply integrated into this emerging new centre of the world's power and wealth. It largely weathered the global financial crisis because of its trading relationship with China, as well as the strength of our banks and quite a generous stimulus package from our government.
In order to better achieve the country's aspiration in the region, the incumbent Prime Minister Kevin Rudd tried a new approach to deal with the regional economic and strategic challenges.
Kevin Rudd is calling for a new Asia-Pacific community which deals with a new world order that recognises that the rise of China and India and deals with the implications of the rise of those two powers. He's motivated by history. The 19th and 20th centuries were the European and American centuries and were bedeviled by conflict over clashes of interest. And in Kevin Rudd's view, it would be a tragedy if the Asia-Pacific century experienced the same fate. Whatever the outcome, Kevin Rudd may have achieved his goal at bringing everyone together to have a good talk about it.
As the world's second largest economy, Japan is also a leading player in the Asia-Pacific region. However, the staff reporter of Kyodo News, Mr. Takayu Karubi, doubts whether Japan positioned itself correctly in the region.
My conclusion is that Japan's stance is very vague. The new government has been adopting a very ambiguous stance on how to form or how to engage itself in so-called multi-layer efforts for regional economic integration framework.
Southeast Asian countries among the economies that have first recovered from last year's economic downturn. Mr. Kavichonki Taobong, the senior editor from Thailand, also agrees that there is a new Asia emerging. He talked about the logic of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, abbreviated ASEAN.
I remember in 1994 when it started out, ASEAN has so-called geographical footprint, said you are not in Asia, so therefore you are not eligible to become ASEAN member. So was Pakistan. And then later on, Pakistan obtained nuclear bombs in 1998. 6 years later, it became a member of ARF. So it's keep shifting. East Asia now include Australia, India, and New Zealand. But before 1997, Southeast Asia is Southeast Asia. Northeast Asia is not East Asia. Now East Asia is 10 plus 3 plus 3. That is 10 plus 6.
Political relation is, of course, a very important agenda on the building of regional architecture. Since Mr. Kavi has helped produce a world-famous documentary, Burma VJ. In the following Q&A session, many participants show their interest about the diplomatic relation between Burma and North Korea, particularly the suspicion that North Korea has helped Burma to develop nuclear weapons.
And I think this, in the future, must need concrete evidence to prove that. And I think it's very important that Rangoon want to develop such a deterrence. I think one of the great enemy of Burma is Thailand, because for years, after 276 years, Burma has annihilated Thai capital, and it no longer can use that kind of cultural superiority. It needs some kind of deterrence to reinforce its superiority. And I think, from my own interpretation, it's a cultural thing. So it wants to develop a great uranium because it has four uranium mines. And that kind of, just like North Korea or those who aspire to be nuclear power, doing that. And I think in the next few months there will be a lot of research coming out to confirm, I believe, that Burma has that ambition. But at the moment, everybody said the evidence has been really weak. And the Thai security force always looked down Burma, said Burma has no capacity to develop the nuclear capacity, even though it was clear that Burma has that ambition and that it can develop the great uranium.
Thank you very much.
And that was Oscar reporting there. Richard McCauley talked to documentary producer and long-term CNN correspondent in China, Mike Chinoy. Here is Chinoy explaining why he decided to create his latest documentary, Assignment China.
Given the enormous clout of the American media, especially in the old days, pre-internet days, what American journalists had to say in their China coverage not only was influential in the States, but all over the world. So at the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California, we felt it would be worthwhile to do a project in which we would go back and talk to as many people who covered China to ask them what they did, how they did it, what were the issues they faced, what were the challenges that they confronted, how did they deal with the Chinese government, how did they deal with their own government, how did they deal with their editors. And through this, we want to get a better sense of how what you consume was produced, because I think that's essential in helping people understand what is going on in China and also how the news media work.
Mr. Chinoy later explained the process by which they produced the documentary.
We began about a year and a half ago, and we systematically started contacting and interviewing as many old China hands as we could. I've been lucky enough to find some people who are still alive who covered the Chinese Civil War and the Communist Revolution in the 40s, who had fantastic stories about what it was like to cover the communists fighting the nationalists to try and get around in a country that had been completely devastated by World War II and then by this ongoing civil war. I've talked to people who went with President Richard Nixon on the trip that opened the door to China, who went in on very tightly controlled journalistic group visits afterwards. And then I've talked with numerous journalists who were able to be based in Beijing after the U.S. and China established diplomatic relations. So it's very, very interesting to sort of see the different kinds of challenges that people face as China itself changed.
With so much change in the past 30 years, I spoke to veteran TV news reporter Jim Laurie to hear firsthand about the ups and downs of reporting in China.
Previously, there had been European and Japanese and other nationalities, but not Americans up until 1979, when the first American correspondents started to go into China and set up bureaus there. It came about as a result of full normalization in January 1979, and the New York Times, Washington Post, and a dozen other American organizations went in to set up bureaus. When they got in there, there was a brief window of what at least we perceived at the time of freedom. There was Democracy Wall, there was a lot of expression that was going on. All the stories that we did initially were positive. And then things began to close down. We had another flowering of expression, of freedom, of contact with local Chinese in the mid-1980s. So when I was back in Beijing and in Shanghai in 1984, 1985, we had a flowering of student movements, a flowering of a whole variety of expressions, and all of that, of course, came to nothing. In fact, it came to tragedy, because this sort of opening up in the mid-80s ended with the Tiananmen Square massacre and the rebellion and the suppression of rebellion all across the country in June of 1989.
Mr. Laurie then explained that the nature of the country, as well as the nature of the government, can often present its own challenges for reporters covering the country.
It's the same challenges as we had when we were reporting in the 70s and 80s, and that is the challenge to get under the surface of China It is a lot easier today. At least there are no restrictions on human contact with Chinese. You can meet Chinese, you can spend time with them, you can have Chinese friends. There were attempts in the 70s and 80s, early 80s, to prevent friendships with Chinese citizens. And that made it very difficult for the journalist to really get to know China very well if he couldn't have any Chinese friends, or if the Chinese friends that he had were always being watched, or he was always being watched. That has changed. And so we have a better opportunity, assuming that we can speak some Chinese and that we can make friends with people in China across a wide spectrum of society, we have a better chance of understanding China. And that's the challenge. In a complex, enormous country like China, how can you possibly get underneath the surface and try to understand a country?
Given such difficulties of understanding such a vast country, Mr. Chamoy then explained the nature of today's coverage of China in the U.S.
Well, there's an enormous amount of information about China available overall because of the Internet. At the same time, though, I think the fact is that with the upheavals in the news industry, you've had a reduction in the number of foreign correspondents for American news organizations, and that has meant, apart from the big establishment news outlets like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, shrinking coverage of China. The American TV networks have been particularly remiss. They have essentially abandoned covering China in any serious way. And so what I think that means is that as the China story becomes more and more important to the entire world and to the United States, the vast majority of Americans are in fact getting less and less accurate journalism to help them understand the country, which I think is a very worrying trend.
Mike Chinoy and Jim Laurie, interviewed by Richard McCauley. Oscar is back. He attended Thomas Crampton's workshop on the promising relationship between social media and journalists. Oscar, could you first tell us what Crampton has talked about during the workshop?
No problem. This afternoon, Thomas Crampton, Asia-Pacific Director of Ogilvy Public Relations, had a workshop about using social media in journalism. Generally, in this session, he first introduced the importance of social media in today's journalism world and later gave some useful suggestions for journalists who want to polish their skills in social media.
Well, what's the best use journalists can make of these so-called social media?
Well, first, Thomas gave the journalists some suggestions that to go Facebook, go YouTube, and go Twitter, because they are definitely the major battlefields of future media. And second, he urged the journalists to get a website and have an online website URL, which is as close as possible to their name. Because once you have it, the next time someone search Google your name, the first result comes up would not be your organization, instead it would be your own blog.
Oscar, I'm curious, what were the journalists in the audience doing while Thomas Crampton was talking? Were they using their own Twitter accounts or their website somehow? Were they posting stuff?
Yeah, it is really interesting to find out that actually some of the audience and the participants of the meeting have already started using social media tools to cover the meeting, like some of the panelists are using Twitter to cover what the people next to him is talking about. So it's actually quite well circulated among the participants.
Oscar, I'm curious again, do you have a website or do you use Twitter?
At the moment, I don't have a personal website or a personal blog, but after the session of this workshop, I'd definitely go for one.
Very good. Thank you, Oscar Lin, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you enjoyed our take on the International Media Conference.